welcome to the May 2018 edition of the RehabCast. This is the podcast of the Archives of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation, hosted by me, Dr. Ford Vox. In this episode, we're going to be talking with Dr. Tom Burns. He's a neuropsychologist at Children's Healthcare of Atlanta, and he's published an important new paper on youth sports concussion and sleep in the May issue. But first, a few news briefs. Don't miss an incredible essay by Dartmouth physician Brendan Riley, writing about his brother's 18-month medical sojourn through 19 different facilities, following what Dr. Riley describes as a fender-bender car accident. You see, Kenneth, as he calls him in the essay, I'm not really sure if that's his brother's real name, has bipolar disorder. And thanks to that diagnosis, he first went to a psychiatric hospital, and various medical complications land him back and forth in an acute hospital with five different acute rehabilitation facilities in between, all of which managed to miss Kenneth's tetraplegia. The essay is truly surreal, and it does a fine job of explaining the horrors of our siloed and blinkered medical system, down to the level of the way different institutions in the same building can't work with each other due to inane rules about what constitutes inpatient or outpatient care. The essay is titled The Best Medical Care in the World, and it's in the May 3rd issue of the New England Journal of Medicine. Stroke care guidelines, published in the March issue of the journal Stroke and released online back in January, are already having large sections rescinded. One of the controversies included the way that the new guidelines dealt with dysphagia, something very near and dear to the rehabilitation community. The guidelines weighted screening for dysphagia lowly despite all the practical benefits clinicians see every day. The American Heart Association, which commissioned the guidelines, has pulled back that section of the document along with several others. The guidelines had a laser-like focus on evidence for outcome benefit, and there's simply not enough randomized controlled trial data for many of the rather basic ingredients of preventing aspiration pneumonia. But I'm not sure who wants to conduct, or what patient would want to participate in, a trial where one arm of patients don't get screened for dysphagia. Now, this latest guidelines battle is part of an all-too-common tug-of-war between evidence-based medicine and our overwhelming lack of good quality data for some of the rather fundamental things that clinicians do. In some cases, guidelines can end up looking absurd and produce documents no clinician ethically thinks they should follow. The AHA expects the writing committee, which it has reconvened, to put forth clarified versions of the deleted sections this summer. The state of Kansas asked the Trump administration to approve a draconian new Medicaid measure that it had in mind, limiting Medicaid coverage to 3 years for working-age, non-disabled adults. After 3 years, you'd be done, with no more access for the rest of your lifetime. Now, CMS Administrator Seema Verma decided against that proposal. She said, quote, "We seek to create a pathway out of poverty, but we also understand that people's circumstances change, and we must ensure that our programs are sustainable and available to them when they need and qualify for them. A ray of sunshine, I suppose." For many patients in Kansas, this measure would have represented a death sentence. The administration is, however, allowing Kansas to put in place a work requirement. Kansas's governor, Dr. Jeff Collier, is a plastic surgeon. And he said, "While we will not be moving forward with lifetime caps, we are pleased that the administration has been supportive of our efforts to include a work requirement in our Medicaid waiver. This important provision will help improve outcomes and ensure that Kansans are empowered to achieve self-sufficiency." Now, they say the states are laboratories of democracy. I just suppose some laboratories work with more toxic ingredients than others. Now it's time for our featured interview. We're talking with Dr. Tom Burns, Director of Neuropsychology and Chief of Psychology at Children's Healthcare of Atlanta at Scottish Rite. Dr. Burns and his colleagues at CHOA have published on assessment of sleep quality and sleep disturbances during recovery from sports-related concussion in youth athletes. That's in the journal's May issue. Dr. Burns, thanks for joining me on the RehabCast today.
Thanks so much.
Now, you've been at Children's there for quite a while now. I'm curious how your practice has changed, and certainly there's a lot more attention now to sports concussion. How has that influenced your practice?
Sure. I've been at Children's Healthcare of Atlanta for 23 years. I started out on the traumatic brain injury unit and working mostly with severe head trauma. About 10 years into it, I shifted in the middle stages there, and I did surgical epilepsy cases and was involved primarily with brain tumors and intractable epilepsy. More recently, in the last 5 years, I've kind of shifted back to the brain injury world, and I've been involved with concussion. I became the medical director for concussion research at Children's. And over the past few years, I've been pursuing some grant funding and building a team. Mostly, we have a pretty strong clinical team. There's 14 neuropsychologists here. So we've been adding the researchers. The last three hires have been people that have been involved with research. So this paper was on sleep, was part of a bigger study. We had a few fellows involved in this, as well as some faculty that joined on at the hospital. And the issue of sleep came up kind of after some of the other studies that we did in looking at development and concussion.
Yeah, and to tackle sleep, you are using part of this kind of larger data set of impact-tested athletes pre- and post-concussion. And it looks like you've got another paper out recently in the Journal of Child Neurology on the effects of developmental age on symptom reporting. Is that using the same data set as well?
It is. It was part of the same study. For the most part, we have a very strong sports medicine program at the hospital, and it encompasses about 30 high school football teams initially, and now there's a trainer associated with each one of those schools. And those trainers are able to give the impact test and to monitor the kids, both baseline and then after a concussion. They've expanded to testing, for the most part, the athletic program. So the girls are involved, the boys are involved. So part of, for example, in this sleep study, the majority were football players, but there was cheerleaders with flyer injuries, and there was volleyball players and soccer players. So we're now getting a bigger cohort of both boys and girls and multiple sports. So,
yeah, it's very interesting how diverse your crew is there. You even have tennis players, and there's a lot of the studies that you see is all in one particular sport. This is nice because it's kind of more realistic for what people are actually seeing out there in practice, the diversity. Now, of course, there's a lot of work out there these days that's really trying to drill down on protracted symptoms after concussion. And of course, this study may help potentially pick out, you know, who's going to have the most trouble. To do that, it is looking at this impact data in particular. Let's start out with, certainly most people in the field, probably most people listening to this podcast are going to be familiar with impact. Give us a brief update on where does impact stand amongst, other competitors, and kind of how do you view it, and kind of what else is available on the market. Obviously, it's perhaps the one with the strongest body of research behind it.
Sure. We have been involved with impact for over many years. It's been a tool that we've used not only with the orthopedic group, but then neuropsychology has also used it. The nice thing about it is we've been able to do comparative studies where we see somebody before they have the concussion and then thereafter. It's a computerized assessment that can evaluate verbal and visual memory, as well as visual motor skills and reaction time. And those four subscales are typically what contribute to kind of a total score that we look at how affected somebody is by a concussion. And we did a study before these two that you've referenced today, and that was a functional MRI study that we did in coordination with Georgia Tech. In that study, we looked at advanced neuroimaging, and we used the impact as well. Surprisingly, we didn't the most significant findings we found were from the self-report of symptoms. And that's what these last two studies in terms of development and sleep have focused on, because we didn't find as much of the neurocognitive differences as we did with how they were reporting and the subjective side of it.
Yeah, that is so fascinating in the concussion world. Now, yeah, you're looking at this post-concussive symptom scale, 22 self-report items. That's the one that Impact incorporates. Do you think that is the best scale, or can kind of consider the gold standard post-concussive symptom scale?
I'd probably say there's two strengths to it, and then there's one weakness that we mentioned in the article. The strengths of it are it covers a wide variety of areas, from things like headache and cognitive dysfunction to sleep, and then some neuropsychological variables. And they do it in 22 items. So it's fairly easy to administer. You can get an idea of where the athlete is functioning. The other thing I like about it is there's a 7-point Likert scale, so you can kind of grade the level of impairment that the adolescent or child is reporting. The future areas, though, are the areas that I would have liked to have looked at after we did the study. Was if you take any one of those variables, it would be nice to have obviously more information. And on the sleep subtest, there's three questions. So we analyzed all three of those questions. But you can use different instruments now. In fact, one of the instruments that we were interested in, we've been looking at now, is the Pittsburgh Sleep Quality Index. And that's actually one of the inventories that's been out of probably in the same academic setting. Impact is located in Pittsburgh, so it's probably out of that same group looking at similar variables. But it's a much more in-depth look at sleep. So certainly after you raise these questions about just different developmental response to sleep and different neuropsychological variables, it would be nice to get more information. Of course, that's a direction we might go in.
Yeah, and of course, your study is one of many that's confirming the great importance of sleep to concussive recovery, and therefore perhaps it warrants the extra time involved and effort involved in really drilling down on that symptom subset. Before we get into the results of your civic study too much, tell us a little bit about, kind of what we already know about the importance of sleep. It seems, I'll just mention that you did cite one study that showed that there were significant neurocognitive measurable differences in kids who got just less than 7 hours of sleep or not, which seemed, quite profound. Even as an adult, I certainly would feel fully rested with less than seven. It's easy to forget how much sleep teenagers need. Give us a little bit of an overview of that literature.
Yeah, so the study you were referencing came out of Nashville. It was McClure and Solomon and their colleagues. And they found that the cognitive deficits were worse when you had less than 7 hours sleep. What was surprising to them is when they looked at even the baseline, that the kids that had less than 7 hours did poor on the baseline to begin with. There was also multiple studies, some with, for example, that has showed with increased sleep symptoms that oftentimes that predicted that you'd have a longer post-concussive recovery. So certainly if you see somebody that's having sleep problems early on, we thought that this would be the next step to looking at that. In the 90s, in the early 1990s, there was a study, Pilcher had a study that looked at college students, and he was trying to look at whether or not poor sleep would influence how they did on testing. And as you're probably not surprised that the kids that didn't get much sleep and did all-nighters didn't do as well on the tests. So the unique part of this study was to take a look at the sleep not before the event, but look at how they did after the concussion. So the aspects of sleep that we decided to look at was not only the quantity or the hours of sleep, but also if there was disturbances, like they were waking up or they couldn't get to sleep or they were either getting too much or too little sleep. So that's kind of, that was the backdrop for where we wanted to go with it. And then obviously to look at if it contributes to the athlete having continued problems because they can't sleep after the concussion.
Definitely. Now, one of the things that pops out at me first, looking at your study population, is the high rate of concussion in the first place. Out of that 1,784 athletes, the vast majority, it looks like, are concussed. 1,206 versus only 578 who didn't sustain a concussion. Do you think that is that typical and a representative of what you think is happening out there?
It is, but I also think the awareness of concussion has increased. Every 6 months, it seems like it feels like it doubles. We get more and more, especially the younger children now, because I think a lot of people are concerned, whether that's the NFL sensitivity and the topic there, or with CTE even, or just people being aware of kids getting hit on the head. But our database, we have the majority of them are baselines, and then you have a much smaller percentage that actually go on to become concussed. So that's one of the reasons we start off with a huge number, and then we kind of boil it down. Part of the things that dropped some people out of this study, too, is if they didn't have full data. Some of the kids are at the schools may not have completed how many hours they slept the night before, and if they didn't do that, they were dropped out of it.
Sure. Now, so certainly the study centers on understanding the difference between these measures of sleep quantity and sleep disturbances, both self-reported. One is, I gather, a single report measure estimating how much you slept, and sleep disturbances is based on three different symptoms. Would you tell us about those?
Sure. So the basis on the sleep disturbance was you can't fall asleep, and then the two others are just either you're sleeping more than usual or you're sleeping less than usual. And like I said earlier, those are pretty broad topics. It certainly gets at the quality of their sleep, but I'm sure we can get a lot more information with other inventories in the future.
Yeah. And you did address this in your paper, but I'm kind of still fascinated by it because I just think, you know, perhaps we underestimate ourselves thinking back of what we were like as kids, but I would be hard-pressed to imagine that I would be accurate if somebody asked me the next day how much I slept, what my sleep quality was. But studies have been done and show that the kids are actually somewhat accurate, certainly more so than their parents, right?
Yes, they have been. They've been pretty accurate. And in fact, the parents typically think they're getting more sleep than they are, which probably doesn't surprise you with the technology age and kids on phones and so forth. It's interesting. One of the things we thought about here is possibly using some technology, these actimetry, which is mm-hmm. similar to what you see on an iWatch or on some of these sports kind of watches that can measure your sleep. And I think there is a, you know, for the future or the future studies, that might be a great way to objectify the exact phases of sleep and to look at it in more detail.
Well, let's get into some of your findings. Certainly, they seem to be split along these two prongs of sleep quantity versus disturbances. On the sleep quantity first, there's some interesting findings there. It seems that one thing certainly leads to another. Poor sleep quality will generate more sleep disturbances, but there's not really a correlation with the neurocognitive scores. So what's your thinking about the usefulness or not of sleep quantity?
Right. I think the thing to remember is we're looking at this after the concussion. So the first time point we looked at was within 7 days. So and that was really more of a scheduling issue than anything else, that mm-hmm. if somebody was concussed, let's say, in an event over the weekend, we could get them in the following week. And so that ranged from anywhere from a day or two after the concussion to up till about seven is when we cut it off. And then we brought them back again close to about 30 days post-injury, which is about 21 days after the initial one. So what was – and usually they were pretty in tune with the sleep because they had gone through, you know, an interview and they had been tested. So they were pretty much on top of the reporting. But the big issues that seemed consistent, whether it was at time one or time two, was the migraine issue, mostly with the headaches. To a lesser extent, the neuropsych variables, but certainly the cognitive symptoms they would report. And what I found interesting is they're reporting the cognitive symptoms, but yet, for example, something like a cognitive symptom would be memory. But then when we gave them a visual memory test and a verbal memory test, they fared pretty well compared to their baseline. So that raises a whole nother issue of whether or not it's in their mind of how their perception of their sleep impacted them, when in fact they might be able to get the resources together enough to do well enough on the test.
Now, you all appear a bit happier with your findings on sleep disturbance, at least with how they're specifically correlated to concussive symptoms. Characterize that for me.
Yeah, so they seemed, I mean, instead of a number of how many hours, now you're looking at that they know they're just having problems. And that was directly related. And the significance was, you know, we were looking at a 0.05 alpha, and they were at the 0.0001. It was very, very significant that of the problems they were having. So, and, you know, we tried to control for things like their gender or the previous concussions. But overall, I mean, the poor sleep generally equates to poor performance.
Sleep disturbances correlate with other symptoms, but measure performance as well. Perhaps I misread. I was thinking that the testing didn't seem to correlate as much, but more so the symptoms.
That's correct. So the neurocognitive would be the visual memory, the reaction time, and they did fairly well on that. They didn't show significant differences on either time one or time two, nor did they differentiate themselves from controls. What we did find with the sleep disturbance side is that regardless of whether you were concussed or not, even if you were a control patient in a baseline and you had poor sleep the night before, you were still going to do poorly on the test. So that raises the issue of the importance of the baseline. If you're testing a child during finals and they haven't slept much and you bring them in the next day after a final and try and do a baseline cognitive assessment, it's likely it's going to be impacted by that studying that was done the night before.
Very good. Now, there's some findings here with regards to visual memory that's interesting as distinguished from other cognitive aspects, and that where it's age dependent in the lower and upper age groups. And it seems there's some research about the sensitivity of visual memory in particular. Tell us about that background and your findings there.
Sure. This was the first study that we started to look at developmental ages to understand the recovery from a concussion a little better. There was some previous work in a journal in 2015 that used the same age ranges, and we felt like the reasoning behind it was good. And basically how that worked was they looked at middle school children between the ages of 10 to 13, and then we separated out the 14 to 15-year-olds and the 16 to 17-year-olds. And that was basically, when you're looking at sports, oftentimes it's 9th and 10th grade, so it's JV versus varsity. And then, of course, we had greater than 17. That was the smallest group we had. But those are kind of the older kids that probably seniors in high school and still on the varsity team. Surprisingly, we did not predict that there was going to be these differences. But for some reason, the youngest group, the middle schoolers, and then the 17 and older, or the older than 17 group, both did poor on that visual memory testing. And that was surprising. Now, there was some previous work that looked at sleep disturbance in a younger cohort and also some in adolescents, and showed that visual memory was lower. So our results did coordinate with some of that. But the group that the previous study, that study looked at just adolescents in general. And what we found is this middle group of 14 to 16 really didn't show they weren't showing the lower visual memory scores. And I'm not sure we completely understand that. You know, some of the issues we wondered about was could there be some reporting bias? But that didn't seem to be the case when we controlled for those factors. So, but clearly the one of interest to us is the middle schoolers from a developmental perspective. And I think it may highlight the fact that the younger children are, in fact, developmentally in a different stage than, for example, the high schoolers. While that may not completely explain why the greater than 17-year-olds had similar problems, it does support some of the previous research that has shown that these young adolescents struggle on the visual side.
Yeah, and perhaps you could argue that they're just kind of more other kind of unusual events occurring at the lower end of that scale and the upper scale in terms of life events and brain development or something. Maybe the people in the middle are a little bit more static. I mean, everybody's changing in the mid-teenage years as well, but I don't know. Just speculating there.
Or maybe that the adolescents are used to not having a whole lot of sleep. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, as far as, you know, kind of what to make of all this, you know, it occurs to me that I guess, like a lot of research, you know, there's kind of always this chicken or egg type scenario, you know, the question of, you know, well, poor sleep could be or sleep itself, it could be a marker of neurological health. You know, it takes a healthy brain to have good sleep. Of course, at the same time, it really takes good sleep to maintain a healthy brain. So it's kind of like a chicken and egg type of thing. You need both. In terms of, you know, I guess that gets at the kind of philosophical question of, you know, exactly what we're measuring here. I think you're proving that it's clinically useful. I suppose we don't know at what point in the kind of neuropathology it is, you know, where the sleep is measuring, you know, certainly stand in for something else about brain health in general rather than the underlying fundamental thing. But what are your thoughts about kind of where in the continuum of pathology where what we're measuring with sleep?
I would agree 100%. I believe the sleep, in looking at this, when you take a step back, you realize that sleep is one of many factors that are contributing to how someone adjusts or how they perform. And I think it's something was overlooked in large part in the past. I think it's receiving a little bit more in the research communities, and certainly with the doctors that are testing with the computerized assessments are starting to pay attention to these factors. For us, it's also raised a question about the different developmental stages that kids and adolescents go through, and how we may need to start looking at those. The database that we started with was very large, and on that second article you talked about in Child Neurology, one of the things we tried to do with that to deal with this issue is we looked at hierarchical linear modeling, which enables you to look at multiple variables at the same time without raising too much of an error factor. And in doing that, we found that certain tests that we gave were much more sensitive at different time periods, which raises the question of not having just one test for a large range of kids and adults, and instead having specific tests. So I think that's a direction we'll probably continue in.
The entire field of sleep and TBI is definitely fertile ground, and I think y'all clearly have some good ideas to carry it forward. Those actigraphy monitors in particular, they're becoming available on everything now, certainly smartwatches and the like. Hopefully you can start to access that kind of data, but it's going to be a real challenge to deal with the numbers that you're talking about in a trial like this. It seems like, though, you're on the verge of really influencing things clinically, like maybe the impact scale itself, into beefing up those sleep query sections. Hopefully, ultimately, we're going to get a lot better at, you know, identifying who's going to have a protracted recovery. Certainly also a hard question trying to figure out what to do about that. Well, you know, I applaud your work. A lot of new, interesting things to think about. Is there anything else you wanted to add before we sign off?
No, I think we covered it. I'm looking forward to continuing with the research, and thank you for having us on.
Thanks for coming on, Tom. It's great to feature the study, and thanks for publishing in the archives. And that's it for this May issue of the RehabCast, brought to you by the Archives of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation. Thanks for listening, and tune in next month for more from the world of rehab.
This podcast is brought to you by ACRM, the American Congress of Rehabilitation Medicine. Don't miss their annual conference coming to Dallas, September 30th through October 2nd, the largest rehabilitation research event in the world, and it's interdisciplinary. Visit acrm.org.